All right. That's our new theme to the children of Israel. Fight. Fight the demons. Fight the flesh. Fight God's enemies. How's everybody doing out there in Pow Talk Land tonight? Herb says, I'm ready. Good. Well, does anybody have anything to share before we start off tonight? Go ahead, Irma. You got the mic. I didn't see your hand. Go ahead. You got the mic. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to your message tonight, Dan. They're a blessing to me. I know you're not only a watchman on the wall, but a real warrior fighting for the Jews. I do believe God has given you so much knowledge, insight, anointed revelation concerning the Jewish people because you have obeyed exactly what his word declared. Quote, comfort ye my people. You lived with them on a kibbutz, labored for them, showed them the pure love of God. You visited Israel frequently, lived there with your family, even stayed beside them wearing gas masks and sitting and hiding with them, offering comfort. If this isn't love, then Steve does not exist. Is there any doubt in one's mind who is teaching lies or who is revealing the truth? I think not. Steve is in confusion, and those who adhere to his teaching are also in delusion. In Paul's day, he put his life on the line, so to speak, teaching truth and exposing those who were not teaching sound doctrine. He reproved and rebuked them harshly, as did the Lord himself. At this present time, God is moving in groups of Christians and some unbelievers also to fulfill his plan, underlying plan, to show mercy and help for his chosen ones. I believe anyone teaching against this plan will himself be accountable of being a part of the great falling away. These are dangerous times, and Satan's greatest weapon is deception. So you keep sounding the alarm and keep blowing that trumpet in Zion, Dan, and we'll all stand behind you. God bless you. And thank you.
Thanks, Irma. Appreciate it. Anybody else quick? Okay, well, I'll do the song I want to do quick before we start here. In acceptance lieth peace. Oh, my heart, be still. Let thy restless worry cease and accept his will. Though this test be not thy choice, it is therefore rejoice. In acceptance, lieth peace. Ceased from sighs and murmurings, seek his lovely face. This thing means thy furthering to a wealthy place. On your fears he gives release. In acceptance lieth peace. In acceptance lieth peace. In his plan there cannot be aught to make thee sad. If this is his choice for thee, take it and be glad, and make from it some lovely thing for the glory of thy King. In acceptance, lieth peace. In acceptance, lieth peace. Oh, my heart, be still. Let thy restless worry cease and accept his will. Though this test be not thy choice,
is therefore rejoice in acceptance lieth peace. Cease from sighs and murmurings, seek his lovely face. This thing means I further aim to a wealthy place. From your fears he gives release, in acceptance lieth peace. In acceptance lieth peace. In his plan there cannot be ought to make thee sad. If this is his choice for thee, take it and be glad, and make from it some lovely thing for the glory of thy King. In acceptance lieth peace. In acceptance lieth peace. Oh, my heart, be still. Let thy restless worries cease, and accept his will. And though this test be not thy choice, it is his, therefore rejoice. In acceptance, lieth peace.
Amen. Okay. Anybody, chime in there, anything before we start? Okay. Let's see. Last week we looked at Mr. Lumley's statement, some of them regarding the return of the Jews to Israel, how that relates to the promises God gave to Abraham. And he believes that the land promises that God gave to Abraham's natural seed were fulfilled in the days of Joshua. Consequently, there's no more land promises to be fulfilled with regards to today's ethnic Jews. And that's why I can say unequivocally that the current state of Israel is not the fulfillment of the land promises given to Abraham. And that's exactly what replacement teachers say also. At the same time, he thinks God is holding today's Israelis responsible for the same land promise conditions, the stipulations, that the ancient Israelites were. In his view, just as God commanded ancient Israel to drive out all the Canaanites, so he is commanding today's Israelis to drive out all the Palestinians. Just as ancient Israel refused to drive the Canaanites out, so modern Israel refuses to drive the Palestinians out. And just as God let the Canaanites eventually overcome the Hebrews and take their land because of that disobedience, so he's going to let the Palestinians overcome today's Israelis and take their land because of their disobedience. And this view of ancient and modern Israel sounds good, sounds right, except for one little problem. If the land promise has been fulfilled historically, then it no longer applies to today's ethnic Jews, including the Israelis. As it is with the promise, so it is with the stipulations that are part of that promise. They no longer apply. Just as the promise cannot at the same time apply and not apply to ethnic Jews today, so the stipulations of the promise cannot at the same time apply and not apply to ethnic Jews today. Either the land promise and its stipulations are still in effect, or they're not. You can't have it both ways. You can't say they both do and don't at the same time. That's confusion. Now, what Mr. Lumley wants to do, as I said last week, is he wants today's Israelis to be held to the same standard the ancient Hebrews were, and he needs to find a way to validate that idea, because it is all the rest of his doctrine removes every bit of scriptural support and covenantal support for that teaching. If today's Jews have no relationship with God, if they're no longer the chosen people, or no longer special in any way, if the land promises were completely fulfilled in Joshua's day, then there's no scriptural or covenantal support for claiming that the Israelis must drive the Palestinians out of the land, or God's going to judge him. And since that's the way he views modern Israel, it's easy for him to, you know, put all the blame for the coming division of the land on the Jews. It's their fault, you see, that they didn't annex the territory they won in 1967. It's their fault that they didn't drive the Palestinians out of Gaza and out of the West Bank when they had the opportunity to do so. So in other words, it's going to be their fault when the land is eventually divided, even though it's the nations who are forcing them to do so. Now, I'm going to play something for you this week. This is going to be a video clip. I'm going to put this video page. I want to show you how the pressure of the nations can change a very strong leader. Okay, I'm going to play a clip. It's actually a 10-minute video of Benjamin Netanyahu 35, 40 years ago. He was up in a committee giving testimony, and he's answering questions and explaining Israel's position. This is 35, 40 years ago. He's very young. He's very articulate. But I want you to compare what he says in this clip to what he's saying now. And you can see how over the years, the pressure of the United Nations, the pressure, the constant pressure of the nations on leaders, the people who are leading Israel, just wears them down. Wears them down year after year after year after year of boycotts and political, you know, statements that are against Israel. A constant barrage of United Nations resolutions that are always one-sided, always against Israel. The constant barrage and pressure of the nations for 10, 20, 30, 40 years takes its toll on people. It takes its toll on even strong pro-Israel people. So I want you to hear the difference between the Netanyahu of 35 years ago and today's Netanyahu, and you can see what the pressure of the world does to a person who wants to protect Israel, okay? This is about a 10-minute clip. I hope my CD holds out.
As my first witness, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mr. Netanyahu, welcome to the Advocate.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Mr. Netanyahu is a graduate of MIT. He is an Israeli, and he is a man who has written widely on this question before the House tonight. Mr. Netanyahu, is the issue of self-determination the core of the conflict in the Middle East?
No, I don't believe it is. The real core of the conflict is the unfortunate Arab refusal to accept the State of Israel. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, for 20 years the Arabs had both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And if self-determination were, as they now say, the core of the conflict, they could have easily established a Palestinian state then, but they didn't.
When did the issue arise then?
Well, for 20 years, we didn't hear a word about self-determination. And in fact, what we did hear, those of us living in the Middle East, was about driving the Jews into the sea. Now, after 1967, under the leadership of the PLO, the hardline strategy shifted to adopting a moderate, dressed-up slogan, which now talked in terms of first a secular democratic state and then replaced it with Palestinian self-determination. But what this really means, contrary to what Mr. Arouri said about 1977 being a changed year in the PLO's objectives, let me quote you what the PLO Information Office said in a Dutch paper in 1977, in May 5th.
77?
May 5th, 1977, yes. The statement was very simple. Our objective remains the destruction of the Zionist State of Israel. So let's keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not the attempt to build a state, but to destroy one.
Do the Palestinians have a right to a separate state?
Well,
Mr. Jam has been talking about human rights.
Well, I think that it's, no, I don't think they do, but I think that it's quite instructive that the Palestinians who are invoking the right of self-determination, which is an attribute for separate nations, themselves are the ones who define themselves as part of the Arab nation. Now, no one is denying that there are Palestinian Arabs. There's a very distinguished Palestinian Arab sitting right next to me. But the Palestinians themselves, in the Palestinian National Covenant, the very first article, say that the people of Palestine, quote, are part of the Arab nation. Well, let's look at the Arab nation. It has 21 states, an area roughly the size of the United States, and one-sixth of the entire world's wealth. Now, add to that the fact that there already exists a Palestinian state. And that is Jordan, 60% of whose population is Palestinian. I think it's quite interesting that Yasser Arafat and King Hussein, who are bitter enemies, agree on one thing, that Jordan is a Palestinian state. So what we're talking about is a demand for a 22nd Arab state and a second Palestinian state.
What should be done with the Palestinians on the West Bank? It's a problem, so what should be done about it, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the Palestinians in the West Bank are going to be offered the full human rights, the full civil rights, as there are no Arabs are offered in the Middle East. No Arabs whatsoever have any full human rights or the right to vote for their own government. Those Arabs who lived in Israel in the P-67 boundaries are the only Arabs in the Middle East to offer that right, and I'm all in favor of having the same Arabs living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip being offered such a right in the final peace agreement.
Can we have peace in the Middle East?
Very briefly, please.
Yes, I sincerely hope so. Look, I'm 28 years old. I've had to defend my country in two wars and in many battles. Nobody wants peace more than Israel. But the stumbling block to the road for peace is this demand for a PLO state, which will mean more war, which will mean more violence in the Middle East. And I think, I sincerely believe, if this demand is abandoned, we can have real and genuine peace.
Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Fagan. Now we'll go to Mr. Adame. Mr. Adame, some questions for Mr. Netai.
Mr. Netai, you've told everyone that the Palestinians on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will enjoy full human rights. Could you tell me how that's compatible with the presence of Israeli forces in their midst?
Well, the Arabs living now under the Arabs who lived in Israel, 400,000 of them, 400,000, between 1948 and 67, as I said earlier, certainly enjoy full human rights. And as I said,
they're the only ones. I'm not talking about the Arabs in Israel. I'm talking about the Arabs on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
If you let me, I'll answer your question, Mr. Ajani, please. The Arabs living in Israel are the only ones who are entitled to vote for their governments, the only ones who have representative in a parliament in the entire Middle East. Now, it's true that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are now undergoing a period of transition. In fact, no Arab government has been willing to negotiate so far about this period of transition. And I think that when this transition, when the negotiation period is ended, there is no reason why under either Jordanian citizenship or Israeli citizenship, these Arabs will not have the full human rights, the right to vote for their representatives, as the Arabs in Israel do, as hopefully all the Arabs in the Middle East will do someday.
Mr. Netai, does the state of Israel itself accept that the people on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have the right to vote on whatever future they choose?
Well, Mr. Ajami, I just outlined that in the event that this negotiation process will continue, I'm sure that what we're talking about is, in fact, eventual citizenship of some kind, either Jordanian or Israeli or in any other arrangement, in which these people will certainly vote.
Mr. Netai, you've given yourself the right to determine that you are an Israeli, but you've also given yourself the right to negate the other entity, which I think is not somehow consistent with global practice at this time, is it?
Mr. Ajami, I have never, never rejected another entity, nor have I ever declared my intent to destroy it, least of all the Palestinian Arabs, who I fervently want to live in peace with. All I'm saying is that it is the Palestinian Arabs themselves, their leaders, Arafat, Mohsen, who Morris Abrams quoted earlier, Farouk Kaddoumi, the number two man in the PLO, these are the ones who say they are part of the Arab nation. These are the ones who say they already have a Palestinian state. There is no right to establish a second one on my doorstep, which will threaten my existence. There is no right whatsoever.
Okay, Mr. Netai, you seem like a very patriotic Israeli. Does not the fact of Israeli dependence upon the U.S. in order to maintain its occupation on the West Bank and the Gaza, does this not trouble you at all?
Mr. Ajami, you asked me as a patriotic Israeli, and I'll answer as someone who has fought in the Middle East. One of the things that I think is unique about Israel, in terms of all America's allies, is that it is perhaps the only one who has taken care of itself so far. And I would think that America, in fact, it's not a one-way street, Israel taking from the United States. Israel is giving the United States an extraordinary bargain in the Middle East. It's the one stable democratic ally which the United States can count on.
Mr. Netai, inasmuch as you're a Zionist and are committed to a Jewish state, given the fact that demographic predictions tell us that there will be an Arab majority within the current borders of Israel, does this not challenge the foundations of the very state which you are committed to?
I know of the latest figures, population figures, that actually show a decrease in the Arab birth rate, particularly in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as a result of the higher education and the universal education for women that didn't exist prior to Israel, prior to 1967. Now, if you ask me, would I reject Palestinians or Arabs living in our midst? Ridiculous. Of course not. They're part of, they're citizens of Israel. If they...
No, I'm talking about the West Bank and Gaza. You see, we're still going back
to the core of it. Yes, I agree. Whatever will be the final arrangement, these people should be free to multiply as they wish. I think that it is written in the Bible, multiply and be fruitful. I think these people should have that right. I'm not going to start enforcing a birth control program under any circumstances.
Thank you. With that biblical injunction, I will thank you. Mr. Abram, one more question to Mr. Netai.
Mr. Netai, since the subject is what should the United States do, may I ask you if you could summarize why, in your opinion, the United States should oppose the creation of a PLO state?
I think the United States should oppose the creation of a Palestinian state for several reasons. The first one being that it is unjust to demand the creation of a 22nd Arab state and a second Palestinian state at the expense of the only Jewish state. I think it also would defeat the hopes of those moderate Palestinians who genuinely want to reach a peace accommodation with Israel.
Thank you. Mr. Ajami, another question.
Mr. Netai, as someone who would say that you believe in democracy, do you believe that Israel can continue as a garrison state and still remain a democratic state?
Mr. Ajami, either you didn't hear what I said before, or for your benefit, I'll repeat it again. No, Israel does not intend to remain a garrison state. Israel wants to live in peace and wants to be secure. If that involves maintaining military guarantees, our own military guarantees against the destruction of people who surround us, yes, I believe we should fight for our survival. If I have to, I'll fight again, but I hope not to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ajami. Mr. Natal, thank you for joining us.
Just wanted you to hear that. 20, 30 years ago, that man was strong enough to say, no, the Palestinians do not have a right to a state. And they certainly don't have a right to a state when it's going to destroy Israel. Now, you look at ways, that is the result of being continually, daily, beat down, bombarded by the nations. So when anybody says, tries to lay out this thing where, oh, it's the Jews' fault, because they're willing to give up land, they don't want to know the truth, they're not looking at the truth, they're not looking at history. Okay? Well, let me go on here with Mr. Wombly's views. During this message of his, he goes on to explain some of the offers Israel has made to the Palestinians. One of the offers they made over the last 10 years was 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza. And he goes on to say, or in that particular offer, he goes on to say, Israel also proposed that the Palestinians, quote, be granted administration over Muslim and Christian quarters of the Old City, that's East Jerusalem. He says, Israel negotiators also indicate a readiness to consider total Palestinian sovereignty over the Muslim and Christian quarters. Palestinians will be granted control. He said, listen to this. This is the Israeli proposal. Our friends, the Israelis, our friends, the Jews, who love us Christians so much, that the Palestinians would be granted control over all Islamic and Christian holy sites and would be allowed to raise the Palestinian flag over them. Now, that's how much Jewish negotiators and the Jewish leadership cared about the Christian so-called holy sites. That's what the Jewish leaders were ready to give the Palestinians back in 1993, almost 20 years ago, up to 91% of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, all the Christian Islamic holy sites. Say, hey, just let us have that temple wall there, but you can have all the Christian stuff. We don't care about that. So the Israelis, according to Mr. Lumbly, are no better than the nations when it comes to dividing the land because, well, they've already offered to divide the land. Consequently, it's not so outrageous for Obama to ask them to give up what they've already offered, is it? And besides, the nations have been telling Israel they must retreat to the 1967 lines ever since 1967. So why are all these right-wing Christians so surprised and so upset at what Obama said already all of a sudden? What's the big deal? Well, one of the things about hearing quotes of what other people say instead of actually hearing them, you know, in audio, you often miss the tone of people's voice. And I wish you could hear the tone of Mr. Lumbly's voice when he's talking about the Israeli offer to the Palestinians. You can express love and compassion and joy and disgust and depression and hatred just by the tone of your voice without saying the actual words. It can all be expressed by how words are spoken. Yeah, but none of those emotions can be conveyed on paper when you're just giving quotes, all right? But when he was saying about that's how just how much, you know, the Jews love the Christians, they're ready to give the Christian holy sites away, he was being very sarcastic. It was a very sarcastic tone. And his disgust for Christians who are continually blessing unsaved Jews who don't care about us one bit at best, and at worst, they hate us. His disgust for that comes through very clearly when he's saying this, okay? When he said, now that's how much the Jewish leadership cared about the Christian so-called holy sites. Hey, just let us have that temple wall there, but you can have the Christian stuff. We don't care about that. He was giving the listener an unspoken message, the tone of his voice, which you can't get on paper. That message was this. He was saying, you Christians who are supporting and blessing unsaved Jews are foolish. You're stupid because those Jews don't care about you one bit. They still hate you, regardless of what you're doing for them. And they're, in fact, they're willing to give all your holy sites away to your enemies. That's how much they care about you. It's a very subtle way he presents his little message. So his other reason for explaining how much territory the Israelis were willing to give away at one time is that he wants everyone to see that the Israelis are no better than the nations when it comes to dividing the land. Because they've already offered to divide the land, right? And since they've already offered to divide the land, it's not outrageous for Obama to ask them to carry out what they already offered. And besides, Obama's no worse than any other president or the nations in general, because everyone's been doing the same thing, saying the same thing through Israel for years. They had to retreat to 1967 lines. You know, so why are you Christians so surprised? Why are you so upset? Okay, in order to prove this point, he gives a little more history, and he quotes Resolution 242. This is what he says. He says, quote, immediately after the 1967 war, the United Nations passed a resolution. It was known as Resolution 242. And the reason I'm telling this is everything that is going on today goes back to this. It goes back 40 years to 1967. Immediately after that war, the UN passed a resolution that said, quote, this affirms that the fulfillment of charter principles requires the establishment of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, which should include the application of both the following principles. One, withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. That's 1967 conflict, right? Two, termination of all claims or states of belligerency and respect for and acknowledgement of the sovereign territory, integrity, and political independence of every state in the area and the right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, free from threats and acts of force. In other words, as soon as Israel had conquered this land and driven off their enemies, the United Nations says, we want you to give it all back. We want you to give it all back and go back to the borders you had before this war. So this has all been leading up to this day, okay? Anybody that was surprised that President Obama would call for Israel to go back to the 1967 borders hasn't been paying attention. And Israeli leaders who thought they could play some kind of game with the Palestinians of saying, oh yes, we want to give them a separate state, but under certain conditions. You know, once Israel accepted the premise of a Palestinian state, this was inevitable. So he's saying, you know, this is all coming down the pike. Everybody's been saying this for years. And Israel's ready to give away the land anyway. What is that? Why is everybody getting so upset? What is your problem? Well, first of all, I think it's Mr. Lumbly who's not been paying attention to the politics of what's going on in history, that he could say Obama's statement about Israel returning to 67 lines, you know, is just business as usual. That's not true. For people who are not familiar with the nuances of the Middle East diplomacy, the way it goes, Obama's statement that, quote, the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, that might appear unremarkable, might appear not much different than anything else that anybody's been saying. But, you see, as is often the case with diplomacy, the context and the speaker are almost nearly as important as the words themselves. Okay, it's not just the words people say. It's who's saying it, and it's how they're saying it, and when they're saying it, and where they're saying it. So even though it's always been assumed that peace with the Palestinians would be achieved through some kind of exchange of land for security, land for peace, the fact is U.S. presidents have been, they've refrained from publicly stating that negotiations should start for the next 1967 lines, you know. Maybe some of you thought it should end there, but most presidents never got up and publicly stated that Israel should start its negotiation point from the 67 lines. I'll just give you a few examples. President Johnson, 68, right after the war. This is what he said. He said, it is clear, quote, it is clear, however, that the return to the situation of 4th of June, that the war started on the 5th of June, 1967 day war. So he's saying before the war. It is clear, however, that a return to the situation of June 4th, 1967 will not bring peace. There must be a secure and there must be recognized borders. President Reagan said, quote, in the pre-1967 borders, Israel was barely 10 miles wide at its narrowest point. The bulk of Israel's population lived within artillery range of hostile armies. I am not about to ask Israel to live that way again. Even George Shultz, back in 88, when he was Secretary of State, he said, quote, Israel will never negotiate from or return to the 1967 border. He said, they will never start negotiation from that point, let alone return to it. So starting with President Lyndon Johnson, right at the Six-Day War, U.S. presidents have often shown great sympathy for Israel's contention that pre-67s do not provide enough security. And even those who did think negotiations should eventually end up back at 67 lines, they never came right out and said that this is the official U.S. policy. If it was said, it was said in back rooms. It was said among themselves, okay? This is why Obama's speech was different. The statement about Israel starting negotiations from the 67 lines was said by the President of the United States in a carefully staged Mideast policy speech at the State Department. In so doing, he has made that demand official U.S. policy. It was never official U.S. policy for him. It might have been unofficial. It might have been the direction people were going. There might have been statements here and there to the press, but it was never official U.S. policy until Obama said it. In addition, many past presidents who have spoken publicly about the need for negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, they've been personal friends of Israel, personally friendly towards Israel. In spite of the political positions they're required to promote, they're personal friends of Israel, they liked Israel, and they gave Israel a lot of secret assurances and stuff. Obama is clearly an enemy of Israel, and everyone knows it. So when he promotes something that is detrimental to the survival of the Jewish state, people understand he means it, and he intends for it to destroy Israel. That's the difference, okay? He means to destroy Israel, and everybody knows it. So when he says that kind of stuff, it carries a lot of dangerous, dangerous weight and consequences. You remember the Gaza expulsion back in 2005. Ariel Sharon was the prime minister of Israel at that point. And when he agreed to expel the Jews from Gush Katif, from the Gaza Strip, he was having a hard time in his own country getting people behind him. He couldn't quite pass all that legislation. And President Bush helped him get that deal done by sending Israel a letter under the president's name in the name of the United States that supported Israel's position that the 1967 lines were not a useful starting point. And that letter infuriated the Arabs, but it helped Mr. Sharon win domestic approval for the Gaza expulsion, which finally went through. Well, not surprisingly, despite Israel's pleas and practically begging Obama, Obama administration has refused to acknowledge that Mr. Bush's letter to Sharon is binding in any way on U.S. policy.